I'm in the English department and in the program of Afro-American Studies. That's what it's called.
Mm. When we talked on the phone the other day, you were telling me how you came to discover this book and you were in New York. Can you kind of start from the beginning and fresh start?
I collect first editions of black texts, and I have a fairly extensive collection. I get the books from University Place Bookshop, which is down on Broadway and 12th, right across the street from the Strand. It's one of the two or three specialty shops in rare black books. So I was in there one day, and I noticed a book on the shelf. It's an old, dusty, wonderful room, and I noticed the book on the shelf, and it was called Our Nig. And the reason I thought it was peculiar is that before the end of the Civil War, no title that I knew of had the word nigger or derivative of the word nigger in its title. So I decided to buy it because one of the things that I study is the image of the black in Western literature, sort of the fictions of black people that non-black people fabricate for various ideological or economic purposes. And I was so sure that that's what this book was, sort of a poor man's Gone with the Wind, that I decided not to read it. I mean, a fantasy of darky strumming the banjo and singing mass in the cold, cold grounds, not exactly something that makes me feel particularly good. But intellectually, I like to account for this kind of representation of the black. So I kept the book for a year. I had just finished a work, a draft of a book called The Signifying Monkey, and I was sort of bored. So I decided to that I would indulge in this plantation fantasy. And I picked up the book, I opened it, and read the preface, and I was convinced immediately that the author of this book was black and was a black woman.
When was this book published?
It was published September 5th, 1859.
Now, apparently this is of great historical interest because there had been no novel by a black or indeed a black woman prior to that time, is that correct, in the United States?
Published in the United States, that's right. There had been two novels published in England by black people, one in 1853, one in 1857, but none had been published, A, in the continental United States, and B, by an Afro-American woman, we thought, before 1892.
Before 1892.
Mm-hmm. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who was quite a prominent writer in her time, published a novel called Iola Leroy in 1892. So this moves the tradition of black women's writing back by 33 years, which in a tradition just over a century old is a dramatic addition.
Were there any books at all published by blacks in this country prior to this one?
Oh, yes. There have been slave narratives, a genre called the slave narratives, which are autobiographical accounts of escaped slaves, people who had run away from slavery, people such as Frederick Douglass or William Wells Brown, and two or three books of poems, but not a fiction before.
Well, let me just get some of the historical things, if that's all right.
Go right ahead.
I'll just get it in my mind. This was the first work of fiction, is that correct?
That's right. First novel published in the United States by a black person.
How did you establish this as a fact?
Well, how did I establish the fact that the author was black?
Yeah, well, how did you establish the fact that the author was black, indeed, mm-hmm. and that it was written by a black woman, mm-hmm. and that there were no books prior to 1859 in the realm of fiction by
Right. Well, there have been a number of great scholars, at least since the turn of the century, who have compiled extensive bibliographies on the writing of the writings of the black. W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, was one who did extensive bibliographies, and a man called Monroe Work down in Tuskegee did as well, and Arthur Schomburg, the Schomburg collection in the city. So we know pretty much what black people did publish from 1773, when Phyllis Wheatley published the Book of Poems, till yesterday. They're very extensive bibliographies. It's easy to tell when you find something if it's been read before, because all you have to do is check one of, say, 100 or so bibliographies. This book was not on there. We have extensive bibliographies of black novels by men, black novels by women, and it wasn't there. So I had no reason to think when I read it initially that, when I purchased it, that it would be a novel by a black woman. I figured that with all these great scholars, I mean, Du Bois was a genius. If Du Bois didn't find it, why would I find it? I mean, how could anyone miss something as dramatically as important as the very first novel written by an Afro-American woman in the United States? The reason that sort of compilation of the literature by blacks has been done so extensively before me, before my generation of scholar, is that Europeans and Americans argued during slavery that only if black people demonstrated their innate mental capacity by writing books, particularly books of imaginative literature, would that black person demonstrate themselves to be more than qualified to be a slave. Now, that strikes us as very arbitrary today, but it's a convention that came out of the Enlightenment in the 18th century and carried over into the 19th century, so that writing for black people was of the utmost importance. One wrote oneself out of slavery.
Who was Harriet E. Wilson?
Well, Harriet Wilson, as it turns out, was an indentured servant, indentured to a white middle-class family in Massachusetts. She had a rudimentary education, some elementary education, we think. She read quite extensively. She apparently was an excellent seamstress. She worked for a while in the millinery industry in Massachusetts, and she perfected a technique of dyeing gray hair black. She was married for a brief time, was deserted by her husband, who left her pregnant. She gave birth to a son. Because of her brutal mistreatment by a white woman to whom she was indentured, she suffered after the age of 18 from drastically ill health, gradually was required to foster her son out to foster home, and decided to write a novel, of all things, in order to earn enough money to retrieve her son. And it was this fact which led to the, remarkably enough, to the discovery of Harriet Wilson's name in my search for the author of this book, which incidentally was published under pseudonym, and for her racial identity.
What was the pseudonym?
Our Nig. Oh. If you look on the title page, it says Our Nig by Our Nig, and Our Nig's in inverted commas. So I had to take that scanty information and try to turn it into reality. Ask me why I thought she was black.
Before I throw it to you, Jane, two questions. This was a vanity book, wasn't it? It was not given to a regular publisher for.
Well, in our terms today, we think of it that way, but books were published in at least two different ways in the middle of the 19th century. One, a book such as Uncle Tom's Cabin was published by a reputable publisher. Most books, however, were published by printers. Books were published by subscription, so that I would take my manuscript to you, the printer, and you would say, how many books can we sell? And I would give you a list and say, these 200 people have promised to buy the book at this price, so that we would engage in a contract for the publication of that book. That, in effect, is what I believe occurred in the publication of Our Nig. But it was printed, not published. I mean, it was printed by...
Well, that would seem obvious from the appeals for her, for the supporting evidence of the in which she is asked, in which the public is asked to buy the book so that she might maintain herself.
Exactly, and further evidence of that, I think, is the existence of an appendix consisting of three letters written by most probably white people, attesting to the authenticity of her tale, and to the fact that the woman wrote it herself, and to the fact that she was black. That's what's so remarkable. The fact that those letters existed all this time, just as part of the book, and a preface in which the author claims to have been black, and the appendix in which the three people say that she was black, and no one ever noticed it before, apparently, or no one took it seriously.
Just two questions, Jane, and I'll throw it to you. Do you have any indication of how many copies were printed of the book?
None whatsoever. I have a copy. I have two copies of this book, two out of ten that are known, first editions, that are known in the United States. And it's numbered 100, and it's signed by Mary Whitcomb in New Hampshire. Now, I don't know if that means it was number 100 in Mary Whitcomb's personal library, or it was number 100 of the first print, the first and apparently only printing. So I don't know, but I imagine it was a tiny, tiny printing, as evidenced by the fact that only a dozen copies that we know of exist, continue to exist in this country. In fact, one, they're so rare that the UCLA library bought one in the middle of April for $1,600.
Now, very briefly, can you summarize what Harriet Wilson has written? What is the plot of the book?
The plot of the book is extraordinary. There's nothing like it in American fiction before the publication of Our Nick, because it's a book about the relationship of a white middle-class woman to a black indentured servant. We don't have a representation, first of all, of a female relationship that turns on economic relations. And second, we have nothing before the end of the Civil War that's not about slavery. It's not a book about slavery. It's a book about white racism in the North. It's a severe indictment of white racist, not at the South, as she says in her preface, but indeed at the North. Now, this was not exactly calculated to win friends and influence people among the abolitionists and the escaped slaves. Remember that this book was published almost exactly 1 month before John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, so that the abolitionist movement based in Boston and in New York needed nothing to make more complex the relationship between slavery and freedom, the South and the North. This book threw a wrench in the works, because it said that there was that racism was as pervasive and as extensive in the North as it was in the South, where slavery existed. So it's a book about the brutal treatment of a black mulatto indentured servant, how she subsequently becomes free, how she meets a black man, marries him, is impregnated by him, and is deserted by him, how she gives birth to a son, and despite overwhelming odds, manages to preserve herself long enough to write a book in the attempt to provide for herself and for her son. That's how the book ends. The other odd aspect of the plot is that the man that she marries not only is less than desirable character, but is a fake fugitive slave. The man who is making his money by going around on the northern lecture circuit, as actual historical people such as Frederick Douglass did, with to great profit and great import. But this man, as it turns out, in the character in the novel, had never even seen the South. And it turns out that he was a fraud. And he admits this to the protagonist of the book just before he leaves, runs off to New Orleans, where he succumbs to that great disease of the American sentimental novel, the fever. So it's a curious book. It's curious, too, because it partakes of the conventions of the sentimental novel, which was a feminist form. Between 1820 and 1870, the bulk of the novels published in the United States were published by women. We tend to forget that now.
Feminist or feminine?
I'd say feminist.
Why?
Well, feminist in the sense that women use the form to define themselves. No matter, we might be uncomfortable about how those relationships were defined, but it was a form used to assert a feminist personality and a feminist being. Though I think politically, obviously I'm not a feminist, but I think politically a feminist might not be so pleased by certain representations of women which occurred in those novels. There's a great scholar, Nina Boehm, who's a professor of English in Illinois, who's written a book about called Woman's Fiction, 1820-1870. And I use a typology of the plot, the received plot, which is shared almost by all these novels, and compare the plot of Our Nig to this received typology. And at very curious points, as I've outlined in the book in great detail, the plot of Our Nig veers away from this received white woman's plot, we can think of it as. And this means that even if I had not been able to find all these concrete details about Harriet Wilson, that I would have had a basis on internal evidence alone for concluding that the author of this book somehow stepped outside of the conventions that obtained in the middle of the 19th century, meaning that she probably was not a middle-class white American woman, and indeed She was not.
Well, what's interesting is that we still have another tragic mulatto. We have a tragic mulatto who is a woman, but mm-hmm. like Clotel, like Eliza, mm-hmm. etc., we still have, like practically everyone in 19th century fiction and in 20th century fiction. Look at Jubilee, etc., who's not, Virey's not particularly tragic. Mm-hmm. But we still have a mulatto woman rather than a black woman, which is interesting as well.
Yeah, it certainly is. Except, I don't think of... When I think of the phrase tragic mulatto, I think of characters less noble, less strong than Fredo emerges by the end of this text, to me. I mean, she's very defiant, she's very ironic, she's very witty, and I don't think of the Clotel, for example, jumping off the bridge to her death into the Potomac. I don't really think of her as a noble character. Fredo, on the other hand, I do. And I think that if this book had been known, that black fiction would have developed in more dramatic ways more quickly than it subsequently did. The black novel didn't really develop, although there are maybe 55 novels published in this country before 1906, written by black people. It didn't really develop into a major art form that was taken seriously until the turn of the century with Charles Chestnut and Paul Laurence Dunbar. This book, however, is much more sophisticated than any other fiction written before 1900, before 1901, when Charles Chestnut published The Marrow of Tradition. It's a much better written book.
How is it so different?
Well, I think that its use of language is much more accomplished. I mean, it's less obviously didactic. It's less obviously rhetorical, though it's certainly didactic and it's certainly rhetorical. It creates a world with much more efficiency than any other novel written by a black person in the 19th century. That means that the tradition, had it been made available to subsequent writers, the tradition of black writing would have developed more gracefully, more quickly, had it been around. Because people build on what comes before. Black people, because our history has been taken away from us in so many ways, and so consequently scholars such as me spend much of my time trying to retrieve that history, black people have been cursed with trying to reinvent the wheel. And if you have a long tradition that you can draw upon, as we do now, say in writing, it's much easier to write, take the next level, to take the next precipice of the mountain, rather than feeling as if you have to begin at the very bottom.
Do you imagine, she's obviously very widely read by the epigraphs, etc., what influence do you imagine that she has read, that she had read large numbers of the 19th century novels that you describe in your paradigm that you had adopted from the scholar?
I wouldn't say large numbers. I would say significant numbers. It would only be necessary to have read one that was typical of the paradigm. But I would imagine she read, maybe a dozen. I think it's a reasonable number. She read widely. You have to imagine how a person, uneducated virtually, and poor, and essentially working class, would have had occasion to read. So that thinking about how long it takes me to read a novel closely, which is the way in which an author reads a novel in order to imitate it, and thinking about what she would have to do to support herself, you would figure that she wouldn't have a whole lot of time to read a whole lot of books. But I think she read closely and read extraordinarily well and imitated very well. And I use the word imitation with the greatest of all great writers imitate. It's like Eliot said, bad writers borrow, good writers steal. Well, Harriet was sophisticated enough to steal the form. But to steal it with a difference. It's repetition with a difference, a black difference, and she made the form her very own. And that is the accomplishment, the sign of an accomplishment of a significant writer. As Alice Walker's Dust Jacket comment says, who knows what Harriet Wilson would have created had she had a room of her own, had she had a voice of her own, had she been able to support herself, had she not been forced to worry about retrieving her son from this county poorhouse in Goffstown, New Hampshire. The tragedy of her story, of course, is that we know that, and this is how I found the identity of the author, I mean, with all the surety, was that almost exactly 6 months after she published her book, her son died in this county poorhouse in New Hampshire. And it was through his death certificate that I found the identity of his mother. So that it was as if the sacrifice of his death was necessary for, to preserve the existence of his mother and her book. So it's tragic. I mean, that's, talk about the tragic mulatto, that is the tragedy of this tale.
The thing that struck me about this book, about the structure of it, was that it seemed to be a fairly easygoing narrative until the final chapter, the end, and she, in effect, wraps it up and says, in effect, that she is wrapping it up very quickly. And her, the final part of her life is just dispensed with.
Exactly.
Almost as if she were in a hurry to finish the novel
because
of financial pressures.
Right. Is that why you think it was?
That's a possibility. That had occurred to me. Because
yeah.
Because it does finish so quickly.
It does, abruptly.
And very abruptly, as if, and also as if she, were suddenly, as, I'm thinking of, all of those 19th century authors who finished by describing what happened to all the characters, as if she knew she had to do that, but she had to do it very quickly.
That's right.
Without any further development.
That's right.
Because
unlike,
I, as a reader, would have wanted to know more about the seaman that she married.
Oh,
of course.
Exactly. And about what was on her mind. I mean, how she felt. You see, you're absolutely right. This chapter is called The Winding Up of the Matter, and it's headed by an epigraph from Solomon, Nothing New Under the Sun, which is the most, the least imaginative of all the epigraphs and the least imaginative of all the chapter titles. Nevertheless, it's the chapter which ostensibly would have been most important to the author. It's the chapter closest to her in time, at the time of writing. It's the chapter that is the realest, as it were, since the fiction and the biography collapse. They meet in that chapter. The narrator leaves the guise of a fiction and appeals directly to the reader in the voice of Harriet Wilson, asking the reader to buy this book so that the author can get her son back. It's as if two textual worlds meet and collide. And I think that the tension of the fictional voice and the real voice of the author, the tension of their meeting and clashing together, is what leads to such a sense of abruptness and the abrupt ending.
Let me ask one more question, and I'll throw it back to you, Jane. We have here in our hands the earliest black novel in the United States. You said a moment ago that that writers build, black writers have built on the experience of other writers. And can you bring us up to date? What is the status of black fiction, and how has it developed since 1859?
Well, I think that one way to approach your question is to be pleased aloud that Aaron Nigg could be retrieved and published in the same year in which Gloria Naylor, the author of The Women of Brewster Place, and Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple, both were awarded American Book Awards, and both happened to be black women, and the same year in which Alice Walker also won the Pulitzer Prize. It's as if the beginnings of the black woman's writing tradition and its present end, of course only temporary, and have met together in one glorious year, and that's what pleases me more than anything else. Black writing has developed splendidly, particularly the black novel. I mean, we have such modern masters as Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, Ishmael Reed, James Allen McPherson, Leon Forrest, Toni Morrison, and Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor, Gail Jones. I think that it's safe to say that the best long fiction writing done in the United States today is being done by black men and black women.
But it isn't being published.
Yeah, it's not being published. Writers such as John Wideman are forced to publish paperback originals because of a so-called lack of a black readership, or lack of a readership interested in black texts, which I just don't think is an honest reason why publishers are refusing to publish these books. I think that the worlds represented in the fictions tend to be unsettling to some publishers, so that there's a bias against certain kinds of black writing. But I think that technically, particularly since Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison and Wright preceded by a great writer of fiction such as Jean Toomer, technically black writing is just extraordinary, and holds its own vis-a-vis any other of the world's literatures.
How do you react to the, or how do you analyze the portrayal of black men in this novel?
Well, there's so few black men. I mean, there's the protagonist's husband, the kind-hearted Jim, whose greatest thrill in the world is to marry a white woman. So that, indeed, is an ironic presentation. And that characterization is framed by her, the protagonist's husband, who lies and is dishonest and is a Rudy Boot, as we might say. So I would say that, at best, black men come off ironically. That doesn't particularly bother me, because I don't think that it's a book. I don't take fiction so much as representations of reality. I take them as self-contained worlds that function with a logic of their own. I don't think that Harriet Wilson was trying to say that all black men fall between these two fictional types, both less than desirable. It's the same sort of argument that Zaki Shange's Color Girls was criticized for. Certain black men thought that the representation of black men in her play was not the most ennobling and did nothing to help the image of black men. I think that the criticisms such as that are a function of a sense of powerlessness. When people who are powerless confuse reality with fictions, with representations of reality.
Maybe I'm confused about one thing. Oh, okay. I'm confused about one thing there.
Don't leave, will you, without seeing me, because I want to talk to you a little
okay.
more. I have to get out to the newsroom.
And I have to go back. I have to go to City Hall. But I do have. I'm confused here because I was under the impression. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. If you're ready.
I'll be around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be in the newsroom. So.
Good. Thank you. I'm going off to Voice of America next.
All right. I was under the impression that Seth was also black.
Yeah, and Seth's
okay,
different.
So you don't mention him. You didn't mention him. He's another undesirable character in that he forces her to give up her children, or one of them.
Right.
And is entirely unsympathetic.
Uh-huh, entirely unsympathetic. I mean, a man ostensibly the best friend, and then who takes over dead man's wife and then forces her to give up. Well, not forces her, but she is compliant in the final decision.
But she's blameless, too.
Well, I don't think that she's blameless.
According to Fredo's.
According to me, she's not.
Of course she is, but according to Fredo, she is she is the typically 19th century motherless woman from Jane Eyre on forward and back.
Exactly.
But her mother is blameless there. She is waiting for her mother to return.
Uh-huh.
There are never any recriminations uttered against her mother.
Right. Except that in the image of the mother created by the narrative strategy itself. I mean, you had no sympathy with that mother.
None, no.
That's what I mean. That is the subtlety of Harriet Wilson's narrative strategy. That was the point I was trying to make earlier about the lack of didacticism. She didn't have to tell us that her mother was a less than desirable person. As soon as we read it, we know. And it's the difference between showing and telling. She shows us, and most of black fiction at this time, until the turn of the century, could not be content with just showing us. The narrator would have had to say, "See, reader, how evil this woman was." And that is a function of this author's subtlety. But you're right about Seth Shipley. I meant to, when I cited the two black men, it was to create a frame for you of the two extremes, but both of which are one-dimensional. But most characters in the sentimental novel, written by anyone at any time, between, let's say, 1800 and 1900, were one-dimensional stick figure characters, so that very few characters emerge with more than one dimension.
And all the men are weak, extremely.
All the men are weak. And that's the other thing that's exceptional about this in the conventions of the woman's novel generally and the sentimental novel specifically, is that it's a novel, as I said earlier, about the relationship of two women, essentially. Two women who in their way are very strong. One woman is strong in her evil and unbending in her relentlessness, and the other woman is strong in her determination to survive. It's remarkable that way. And in fact, though I didn't say this in the introduction, I've subsequently thought about the ironic relation the plot of this book has to the current feminist movement. The fiction of the feminist movement, just like the fiction of the Black Power movement in the late 60s, was that once we, quote-unquote, take over, things will be different. Harriet Wilson, at the end of the decade of the 1850s, has critiqued this thesis in advance. She says things are not only no different, when a woman runs the world. But in her case, they were drastically negative. In fact, the only relieved suffering, there are exceptional minor characters who are women, of course, which is a stock convention of the sentimental novel. But the only relief in her suffering, as you say, as you suggest, comes from these weak men. And the men aren't weak in that sense, in that they're very sympathetic with her, which
but
I think
they don't really take any action.
They don't take action, no. But the fact that they can even utter sympathy is a form of action. I mean, didn't do much to help Fredo's condition. At times they took action. Of course, the suffering son with whom Fredo, I think, is in love, insisted that she eat at the table, insisted that her mother not beat her in certain ways, and only his powerlessness caused by his eventually fatal disease keeps him from taking her away. So that the novelist makes him powerless too, in a way, I think, to keep uninterrupted this relationship between evil white woman and good black woman. You see, I mean, it's not as if reality created that. I mean, Harriet Wilson created this tale. Everything that happened in it, she created. Although we have every reason to believe now, because of our research, that many of the events actually happened in her life.
I found it absolutely fascinating. I was visiting my aunt on, I just got this about 2 days ago. I was visiting my aunt, and I had stayed overnight at her house, and she stayed up far later than I did, reading.
That's wonderful.
Reading, she didn't read the introduction, so she demanded that I return and bring back these so she could finish reading the so she could start on the introduction. But she just read the story. I found it absolutely fascinating, and I had wanted to get a copy of it, so I'm glad Don arranged this.
You've read it very well, and the important thing to me is that you, as a black woman, do find something to relate to in this book. A number of people approached me right before Mother's Day, a number of people who happened to be black women, people I didn't know, I mean, mm-hmm. called me out of the blue or came to Connecticut and asked me to sign copies for their mother.